about having an underground threesome with Shan and Robbie, and feeling myself turn red and hot with my sweating, embarrassed horniness. I also wanted cupcakes. Welcome to Eden. If driving out to the tally-ho with Robbie Breeze was like traveling forward in time, then climbing down into the belly of the McKeon silo with him was like going backwards. First, Robbie climbed down the rounded steel ladder, and Shan and I followed. As soon as Robbie was halfway down to the floor, which was 15 feet below the hatch opening, a welcoming sound chimed us into the silo. It was a recording of a very sterile, anesthetized-sounding woman's voice that said, "Welcome to Eden. Please secure the hatch upon entry. Welcome to Eden. Please secure the hatch upon entry. Welcome to Eden. Please secure the hatch upon entry." I said. The message kept repeating without any indication that it would stop. I added, "Shan, if this place ends up being full of sperm, I'm leaving." The place did have sperm in it. We found it later. You will see.
"It's just like our mothers or something," Shan said. "I bet she won't shut up till one of us closes the front door."
Shan pointed up to the hatch and the disk of blue Iowa sky above our heads. Shan was very smart. I thought it was like our mothers because the voice sounded like the two Connies, Connie Breeze and Connie Zerba, when they were floating along on little blue kayaks.
"Welcome to Eden. Please secure the hatch upon entry. Welcome to Eden. Please secure the hatch upon entry."
"Okay," I said. "I can't take it anymore." But before I could do anything, Robbie was back up the ladder, sealing shut the hatch above us. The welcome announcement stopped. Robbie looked down at us from the top of the ladder. I said, "What if we can't get out, Rob, and this chamber suddenly begins filling up with sperm or shit like that?" Robbie said,
"Eden 5 needs us, porcupine."
I repeated.
"You worry too much,"
Robbie said. That was very true. Everyone knew I worried too much. Absent-mindedly, I fiddled with the silver St. Casimir's bauble dangling from the chain around my neck. Some kind of sign. The diving bell turned out to be much more than a diving bell. It was a bunker fortress, a preserved glimpse, like Paleolithic cave art, at the paranoia that gripped Cold War Ealing, Iowa, and the United States of America. It was everything in the entire world down there. You will see. The first room below the hatch was something like a mud room. There were benches along its circular wall, with coat and hat hooks positioned at even distances above them. The wall was painted in an industrial shade of gray with bold yellow block letters that said, "McKeon Industries Infestation Complex, Eden Project, Ealing, Iowa." There was a pair of scuffed wingtip shoes left beneath one of the benches, as well as a powder blue windbreaker hanging from a hook. There was also a matching set of three of the same plastic pink lawn flamingos with the wire stakes coming out of their asses. The wire stakes were fed through perfectly drilled holes in the benches. The flamingos were turned with their beaks toward the center of the mudroom, like they were watching us.
"This must be some kind of nuke shelter," Robbie said.
"Nah," I said. "It has something to do with that shit Tyler dropped." Shan said,
"What are you talking about?"
"Let's see what's down here," I said. A single metal door led out of the entry room. The fact that this door also had a sealing airlock mechanism convinced me that the silo had been created for some anticipated disaster. A reasonable observer might conclude that Dr. Grady McKeon had prepared the structure, as many Americans did during the 1960s, as a type of bomb shelter for his family. But I knew after what I'd seen inside Johnny McKeon's office at From Attic to Cellar Consignment Store that there was something much more to this silo and to Grady McKeon's creations. I was certain Robbie believed it, too. None of us had any way of knowing it at the time, but Robbie Breeze and the bloody message he left on the pavement at Grasshopper Jungle had just as much to do with the end of the world as old, dead Dr. Grady McKeon ever did. We went through the first door. Robbie said,
"I don't mind telling you this, Shan, but I think you should keep this place secret from your parents, so we can have a raging party down here."
"Like an orgy," I whispered.
"Ugh,"
Shan said.
"We could rule the world from this place," Robbie offered.
I wasn't really listening to them. I was nervous about being there, and I was silently communicating to St. Casimir's, asking him if he could make me stop thinking about having an orgy. In the early 1970s, among the last times anyone had ever been down inside the McKeon silo, which was technically called the Eden Project, scientists and workers from McKeon Industries actually did come down here to have sex parties. We would find this out later, much to Shan's embarrassment. The doorway led us into a vast tiled hallway of lockers, which in turn opened on either side to a wide shower room on our right, sinks and mirrors to our left, with gleaming stainless fixtures and hospital-clean floors and walls. I went inside the shower room. The shower heads were arranged like sunflowers, blooming outward from the tops of central posts that looked like columnar periscopes in old submarines. 20 people could shower in there at the same time. The place was obviously designed with the idea of not segregating shower takers and clothes changers by gender. I opened one of the spigots. The water came out hot. The place was suitable for an army, and it was also ready to be used. "Too bad I already took a bath today," I said.
"Yeah, too bad," Shan said.
She was joking. In the shower chamber, at the end of the room where there were polished redwood benches and cubbies for towels and clothes, there were 3 doored stalls to toilets, and an enormous 20-foot-long porcelain communal wall urinal. I examined the top of the urinal. There were birds on it with ribbons coiled around their happy beaks. The urinal was an antique nightingale. I knew I would have to pee in that thing. My destiny was calling. Once again, every highway that had ever been laid was intersecting right at my feet. I rubbed the St. Casimir's medal against my chest and thanked the Virgin Boy. Robbie had opened some of the lockers. They all contained identical sets of supplies. Clean towels and shower kits with soap and razors. Fresh white and blue nylon jumpsuits that zipped up the front. Sealed packages of white socks. And cloth caps, all of which had been embroidered in blue and gold thread with the McKeon Industries Scientific Labs Department logo. All the jumpsuits were numbered and said Eden on their chests.
"I wonder if we should change our clothes or shit," Robbie said.
"If there's one in there that says Eden 5, I am putting it on," I decided. Robbie waved a hanger like a banner in front of me. On the left chest, the jumpsuit said this: Eden 5.
"This is like some kind of sign or shit," I said.
"Gimme shelter." The uniform made me look like someone who worked at a place that sold hot dogs and ice cream cones. I stripped down to my boxers and slipped myself hurriedly inside the jumpsuit. Shan and Robbie gave in to their desire to conform. All teenagers really want to be exactly alike, so why wouldn't they? Shan and Robbie put on uniform jumpsuits as well. Watching Shan and Robbie take off their clothes made me realize that nylon jumpsuits were also not very good at hiding erections. St. Casimir's kept me strong. I wanted a cigarette. Shan Collins was Eden 49. Robbie Breeze became Eden 133. We put on our white caps and socks. We were an army now. There were a lot of lockers down there, enough to find suits that fit us perfectly, enough to last forever. "Do you think this place would explode or shit if we smoked down here?" I asked. Robbie said,
"I was wondering the same thing, Porcupine."
The place did not explode. I noticed there were ashtrays built into the walls of the locker room. Everyone smoked in the 1970s, especially in Iowa. Who wouldn't smoke if you were sealed underground and the world above was going down a cosmic shithole? Walking silently over the cool, slick floor in our brand new McKeon Industries Scientific Labs Department white socks, we left the locker room through the only hatched doorway at the opposite end from the entry. We came out into a massive auditorium with rows of cushioned seats that all faced a podium and rolling blackboards at the front of the room. It was like a lecture hall. The stage area was lit up in track lights that pointed down at the lectern, so the audience's attention would be focused on whoever might be up there, telling them all the important shit they needed to know. On one of the chalkboards behind the speaker's podium, a diagram had been drawn. It looked like this: 412E, to human blood host, to larval stage, to metamorphosis, to sexual reproduction, to infestation. It was just like biology class with polywogs. I hated biology, and as far as I know, polywogs cannot destroy the world. Then again, I never paid attention in biology class unless the teacher was talking about sexual reproduction with humans. Our 9th grade biology teacher at Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy was named Mrs. Edna Fitzmaurice. She had a mustache and would not tolerate nervous giggling when she said a word like penis or vagina. Edna Fitzmaurice's main function at Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy was to make teenagers morbidly terrified of sex. History lesson. Over the course of centuries in the history of education, although fought valiantly by endless armies of pedagogues, the attempt to frighten teenagers away from sex has proven to be a losing battle. The lecture hall had multiple sets of doorways leading out from each of its three curved walls. There was so much for us to explore. The place was easily 5 times larger than the McKeon house where Shan lived, maybe bigger than that. The first door we opened took us into a type of lounge. It looked like a television set from a 1960s-era family comedy, with low, straight-backed sofas perched on narrowly tapered birchwood peg legs, shag carpeting, and coffee tables shaped like kidney beans. On one of the tables was an assortment of magazines. They were perfectly unwrinkled, dustless, hardly touched. The most recent date on any of the magazines was 1971. There were framed photographs on the walls. An image of the flag of the United States of America planted on the surface of the moon. The faces of presidents carved into Mount Rushmore. A herd of longhorn cattle. What apparently were Iowa cornfields. Willie Stargell swinging at home plate in the 1971 World Series. And a black and white picture of President Richard Nixon and his family, taken in the White House in front of a fireplace. And a painting of President George Washington. It was everything that made America worth living in an underground cave for, while the rest of the world went entirely to shit. That was our day. You know what I mean. And there was a cigarette machine in the lounge. Discovering it had an almost religious impact on Robbie and me. "Thank you, St. Casimir's," I said. I pulled my medal out from my jumpsuit and kissed the saint. "You're going to go to hell for turning Catholic," Robbie said. Robbie pulled one of the levers on the machine. Out popped a red pack of Pall Mall cigarettes and a book of matches that advertised how you could get into art school by drawing a cute little fawn named Winky. You did not need to put money into the machine to get cigarettes out of it. It was a miracle. Robbie said, "Thank you, St. Casimir's." We sat on one of the couches and smoked. The Pall Mall cigarettes were a little stale, but they were free. I had read somewhere that cigarette manufacturers during the 1970s also put saltpeter in their tobacco. I wondered if Americans had fewer erections during the 1970s than during other decades. Apparently, the saltpeter in my Pall Mall was not having much of an effect on my penis. I sat beside Shan and rubbed her leg with mine. The jumpsuits felt very nice. I put my hand on her neck. We kissed, and I slipped my tongue into Shan's mouth. I believed Robbie was a better kisser than me. I tried to kiss Shan like Robbie would. Robbie watched us. He was not bothered at all by what I was doing with Shan. He got up from the couch and went over to the wall, where a built-in shelf surrounded an old reel-to-reel tape recorder. There was a big spool of tape that had been left threaded across the machine's playheads. Robbie pressed the power button, and the 2-level meter windows on the bottom of the machine flickered with yellow light. There were red needles that looked as fine as strands of horsehair, and they pricked up inside each window. Robbie flipped a switch. It made a soft click, and the reels jerked and spun. Music came from everywhere around us. It was a recording of the Rolling Stones album, Let It Bleed. Robbie said, "Oh, hell yes." Robbie danced and smoked. He was such a great dancer. It was just like when he taught me how to dance in his room at the Del Vista Arms, so I could win Shan's attention when we were in 7th grade. I wanted to dance with Robbie, too. Robbie said, "I never want to leave Shan's silo." Mick Jagger sang Gimme Shelter. History will show that Gimme Shelter is one of the greatest songs ever recorded. It sounded so beautiful down inside Shan's silo. Robbie danced in his jumpsuit, which he had unzipped all the way past his belly button, so you could see his brightly colored, non-plaid, non-Iowa boxers. They had pictures of ice cream cones with rounded scoops of colorful ice cream melting down the diamond-patterned waffle cones in suggestive drips. Robbie always had the coolest boxers. He waved his hands around and tilted his cigarette daringly from his lips. "Oh, a storm is threatening. My very life today." I got up and danced with Robbie there in my jumpsuit and socks on the thick shag carpeting in the lounge room. It all felt very good. Shan joined us. The three of us danced together. It made me very horny. I said, "I never want to leave Shan's silo." Shan smiled and danced between Robbie and me. We were in Eden. Eden needed us. All roads crossed on our dance floor. The Dragon Parade. We danced and danced. The tape played. We were sweaty and hypnotized. And we lost ourselves as the music fell all around, washing over us. I said, "I love you, Shan. I love you, Robbie." What was I going to do? Shan and Robbie smiled at me. Shan combed her fingers through my wet hair. Robbie touched my hand with his. We danced and danced. And while I danced with Robbie and Shan below the ground, things happened in the world above. Ingrid, my golden retriever that could not bark, was exhausted from being outside and watching me mow the lawn and scoop up dog shit all day. She was curled up beneath my desk, asleep and content, waiting for me to come home. Ah Wong Sing and Connie Breeze were lying naked together in bed. They had had sex 3 times in 1 hour. Ah Wong Sing was a real dynamo for such a quiet guy. The pancake house cook and Connie Breeze smoked a marijuana cigarette that Ah Wong Sing had rolled before coming over to the Del Vista Arms. They also used up the last of the condoms Connie Breeze had found on the floor of Robbie's bedroom. The family from Minnesota who had come through Ealing the previous Saturday on their serial killer road trip were heading back home to Minneapolis. They bought a Stanpreme pizza to go and had a picnic on the benches at Amelia Jinks Bloomer Park. It was not a good idea. Nobody in Ealing, Iowa ever went to Amelia Jinks Bloomer Park. Some parks are unexplainably like that, unused, as though there is some unspoken recognition there might be a sort of toxic pall hanging over them. In fact, Amelia Jinks Bloomer Park was built on the site of an old chemical milling and etching plant. The tanks there had corrupted, and poisonous metals from them seeped into the ground. Swallowing water from the drinking fountains at Amelia Jinks Bloomer Park was just a little safer than sucking on a nozzle of unleaded premium at the Arco on Kimber Drive. Nobody knew anything about that. The twin boys drank and drank from the fountains at Amelia Jinks Bloomer Park in Ealing, Iowa. They filled squirt guns again and again with Amelia Jinks Bloomer Park's drinking water. It did not matter. The family sat and looked over their memories in their guidebook. Before Amelia Jinks Bloomer Park was an abandoned park, United Chemetch Incorporated's parking lot occupied the exact spot where the picnic tables were located. In 1969, the decapitated head of an adult white male had been discovered in that parking lot. It was a perfect place to have a family picnic. The father remarked how fresh the sausage meat was on the Stanpreme pizza they had bought. The Hoover boys, at least the bugs that hatched from the Hoover boys, Tyler, Devin, and Roger, scampered with clicking mechanical jerkiness across the Little League field adjacent to the picnic area. They audibly buzzed with horniness and hunger. One of the twin boys saw them. He said,
"Look, a dragon parade."
It was not a dragon parade. Mantises are very quick. It's not that the bugs that hatched from the Hoover boys and the other victims of contained MI plague strain 412E were precisely mantises, but they were close enough in physiology, with their triangular heads and viciously barbed trisegmented striking arms. And they also stood 6 feet tall. In battle, a 6-foot-tall praying mantis could easily destroy a 6-foot-tall grizzly bear. They were like grizzly bears with steel plating and lightning-fast arms studded with row upon row of shark's teeth. The bugs that hatched out from the victims of contained MI plague strain 412E liked to snatch their prey up by the head and then commence eating their thrashing victims straight down to their shoes. The dragon parade made a bloody mess at Amelia Jinks Bloomer Park. They were very quick. They even ate what was left of the tourist family's Stanpreme pizza before scurrying off to look for more food, and also for Eileen Pope, who they could hear and smell and wanted to fuck. And while we danced and danced, my mother swallowed another of her little blue kayaks. She had gone back to the hotel with my father. My father was leaving a voicemail message on my cell phone at exactly the same moment that Shan and Robbie danced with me. The message was this.
"Hey, Austin. We've been sitting with Eric, and he looks good. Real good. He is going to be fine, son, so there's no need to worry about your big brother. He is a hero. Call me and let me know how things are going at school. I hope you're eating okay, and not just cup of noodles and shit like that. And don't forget to let Ingrid out. I love you, son."
Happy hour was beginning at the tally-ho. Thursdays were good days there for men to meet new men who were daring enough to finally try their luck at the tally-ho. Will Wallace was drinking a beer at the bar, while Shan ran her fingers through my hair, and Robbie brushed my sweaty hand softly with his. Will Wallace was not homosexual. The tally-ho sold beer for 70 cents per glass during Thursday happy hours. Will Wallace also enjoyed the attention he got from men who showed up at Waterloo, Iowa's one and only gay bar for the first time. Will Wallace had no idea he was spending his last evening on Earth in a bar for homosexual men. At the same time Will Wallace was finishing his second glass of beer at the tally-ho, Mr. Duane Coventry, our chemistry teacher at Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy, was tapping on the front door at Tipsy Cricket Liquors. He needed a bottle of whiskey. Duane was single, and he drank a lot. Nobody opened the door for him, so he got back into his car and drove to the Hy-Vee, where Connie Zerba worked as a bookkeeper, At the Hy-Vee, Duane Coventry purchased 2 boxes of antihistamine tablets for his allergies. He did not have allergies. The chemistry teacher from Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy was a real dynamo when it came to cooking methamphetamine in his kitchen. Duane Coventry was very lonely. He should have tried hanging out at the Tally-Ho. Hungry Jack, whose real name was Charles R. Hooford, but was now a massive green bug that looked like a praying mantis, and Travis Pope, who was also a massive green bug that looked like a praying mantis, were back in the alley at Grasshopper Jungle. They were fighting over mating privileges with Travis's wife, Eileen Pope, who was also a massive green bug that looked like a praying mantis. It didn't matter. Travis had already inseminated her 12 times that day, and now he was more hungry than horny. There was plenty of Eileen Pope to go around. Eileen Pope was about to become queen of a new world. Once her 6 suitors got to her, they would collectively fertilize millions of eggs inside Eileen Pope's burgeoning abdomen. It would take her several days to produce and hide her egg mass, but then in a matter of hours there would be more hatchlings from those first 7 victims of the contained MI plague strain 412E than there were people in the entire state of Iowa. The world would have just about 7 days before the bugs started taking over. And bugs only want 2 things. So Travis Pope submitted to Hungry Jack and scuttled away down the alley behind the Ealing Mall. Travis Pope hunted for someone to eat. Hungry Jack joined himself to Eileen Pope as she clamped 4 of her arms onto the dirty convertible sofa in Grasshopper Jungle and buzzed with contented fizzling coos, like a short-circuiting wall socket. We danced until the entire tape played through and flapped its disconnected end over and over around the receiving spool in an unending counterclockwise loop. Shannon, Robbie, and I were soaked with sweat. The 3 of us collapsed onto the thick shag carpeting, panting and staring up at the high ceiling overhead. Shan said,
"Let's try to find something besides shower water to drink."
I said, "I want to go piss in my great-great-grandfather's urinal."
"So do I," said Robbie.
History often loops around into complete circles. The spool of tape spun and spun. Soup from paint cans. Unze Sturba's American name, the one with swapped out consonants and shit, was Andrew Zerba. Unze Sturba was my great-grandfather. His mother was Eva Nightingale, and his father was Chris Sturba, who Americans renamed Christopher Zerba, manufacturer of palatial urinals. Robbie and I peed all over the gleaming receiving wall of Chris Sturba's beautiful urinal.
"This is the greatest urinal ever made," I said.
Robbie stared at the spot on the wall where the disembodied praying hands would be hanging if this were Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy.
"Very accommodating and unoppressive," Robbie offered.
If the act of urination had self-esteem, it could not help but feel better about itself after occurring in such a splendid location, I said. Robbie said,
"Without a doubt, this is the nicest thing I have ever urinated on, with the possible exception of Sheila's husband's new Harley Davidson."
Sheila was Robbie's sister, who lived in Cedar Falls. "You peed on your brother-in-law's Harley Davidson?" I asked.
"He wasn't my brother-in-law at the time, but yes, Porcupine, I peed all over the seat," Robbie explained.
"Why?" I asked.
"I'm not really sure," Robbie said. "Something inside me just told me that motorcycle needed a good peeing on."
"Well, I have never peed on anything that was particularly nice, except for maybe the grass on the football field at Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy," I said.
"You peed on our school?" Robbie asked.
"Yes," I said. And then I asked,
"Robbie, are we done talking about peeing yet?" "I'm pretty sure we've said everything that needed to be said, Austin," Robbie answered.
"We should probably shake hands," I said.
"Meet me at the hand soap dispenser," Robbie answered.
Unze was 17 years old when he left home, the same age his father was when Chris Sturba found himself entirely alone in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. The Great Depression had arrived in the United States of America, and urinals, even beautiful ones with names that sang, were no longer in high demand. Growing up, Andrew, Unze, always felt there was something quiet and troubling that made him different from other boys. You know what I mean. Chris Sturba's boy was often afraid and confused, just like another Unze who was going to be his great-grandson. Since he was born, his father, Chris, only spoke to his son in Polish. Unze Sturba rescued an injured bird when he was 13. That would have been the same year he was in 7th grade in Minnesota, where his father ran the Nightingale Convenience Works. History shows that lots of shit happens to Polish boys when they are in 7th grade. I do not know why, but that is not my job. My job is saying what? The shit that happens to us Polish boys is causally related to the bags under our eyes. The bird Unze found was a European starling. Unze kept it and raised the bird as a pet. He named the bird Baby. By the time Unze was 17 and left home, Baby could talk. Baby spoke English as well as Polish, which displeased Eva Nightingale, who believed that Kreese and his son frequently conspired against her will and plotted in their anarchist's tongue. She thought the bird was in on the Polish conspiracy, too. Whether or not Baby actually understood the things he said was always a matter to be decided by the person listening to Baby speak. Unze loved Baby. He never kept the bird in a cage, either. In fact, Unze tried to encourage the bird to fly away and find a suitable mate or a more natural place to live, but Baby would not leave Unze. Baby preferred to stay inside Unze's coat or perch near his collar at all times. People in southern Minnesota, where Unze was a boy, thought Unze was crazy. You must be crazy, after all, if a bird loves you. In 1933, when Unze was 17 years old, he and Baby found themselves at the very center of a vast continent. They were somewhere in the state of Iowa, in a place called Boatman's Bluff. Unze, like a lot of young men during the Great Depression, was more or less a hobo. I also do not know why people say more or less. Everything is more or less of anything you can think of. Iowa is more or less the French Riviera. The French Riviera has the largest per capita consumption of Spam in the world, more or less. That is more or less the truth. Unze was a hobo. On a frozen morning in April, Unze arrived at a farm foreclosure auction. Sometimes, he went to these auctions just to stand in the midst of the people, where he could stay warm. Often, when auction goers saw how young Unze was and what a beautiful face the boy had, they would invite Unze home and feed him and allow him to take a warm bath or sleep for a while in their outbuildings. It was natural for kind-hearted people to feel a sense of sadness or obligation when they looked at young Unze, all alone and helpless. He'd looked like an angel, or like an injured bird. Perhaps it was that people were also attracted to the strange talking bird that stayed inside Unze's collar and nuzzled against the boy's neck, which was the color of hominy grits. That kindness people sometimes showed him was what Unze was looking for on the morning in April at the farm foreclosure auction. Unze was very hungry, and the ground of the dead farm was frozen in such deep black ruts that it hurt his feet when he walked through the crowd. Unze ran into another drifter among the people at the auction, a 19-year-old boy named Herman Weinbach, who had come from Michigan. Herman Weinbach's straight hair, which was the color of pot roast gravy, hung down across one eye. His skin was the color of soda and flour biscuits. Herman Weinbach had been a member of the American Communist Party, but he quit all political activities due to hunger, he explained. People were leaving the American Communist Party in the early 1930s, and Herman simply didn't believe anything was ever going to change, whether it was destined to, as Karl Marx said, or not. Herman Weinbach was also homosexual, but nobody knew anything about it. When Herman Weinbach saw Unze Sturba at the auction, he asked Unze if he was a Jew. Unze told him no, that he was Catholic, and Herman said that would have been his next guess, after Quaker. Herman Weinbach was a Jew, but nobody knew anything about that either. He told Unze he was an atheist. Unze Sturba had never met an atheist before. At least, he had never met anyone daring enough to say they were atheists. Just the thought of denying God frightened Unze, who, like me, frequently touched a silver medallion of St. Casimir's he constantly wore in a chain around his neck. Before Herman Weinbach died, he told Unze Sturba that being a communist homosexual Jew in Iowa in 1933 was like being a European starling that spoke two languages. Unze did not know what Herman meant when he said that, but I believe he meant it was something beautiful and wonderful. The boys found a man in the crowd who was smoking. He gave Herman and Unze some tobacco, and he let them roll cigarettes. Cigarettes were a good way to not feel so hungry. That day, Unze and Herman became great friends and traveling companions. They shared their hunger, and Unze showed Herman the tricks he could do with Baby. The boys had to go to a soup kitchen in Ames to get a meal that day. They had to wait for other boys to finish eating, so they could borrow something to hold soup for themselves. Herman and Unze had nothing except a talking bird named Baby. They ate out of borrowed paint cans. The boys who loaned them their paint cans waited for Herman Weinbach and Unze Sturba to finish their meal. You just don't give away empty paint cans when there's soup that needs to be ladled out. This is the truth. It was America, and America had very little to spare for boys like Herman Weinbach and Unze Sturba. Herman was going to California, he said. he told Unze about his uncle, a man named Bruno Wojner, who had trained an amazing dog act for a circus. The name of the circus act was Bruno's Amazing and Incredible Dogs. Hermann said his uncle, Bruno Wojner, would be very excited about Unze's talking bird, and maybe they could go to work at Bruno's circus in California. Unze thought California would be much better than Iowa, even if it was only a different place to starve and be cold. So the boys decided to try to go to California together and find Uncle Bruno and his amazing dogs. They made a pact to stay together, Hermann, Unze, and Baby. Of course, Unze never managed to leave Iowa, but the idea was good and romantic. That's what all Polish boys like when they are 17 years old. Romantic ideas and somewhere to go. Unze and Hermann ate their soup from paint cans and saved half of their bread for later, and also to feed to Baby. Things like this were what made America great. Romance, talking birds, eating dinner from paint cans, and setting off with your friend to see the world. There was an entire world inside Shan's silo, which was actually called Eden. The world was frozen in time from around 1971. That world included telephones wired into the walls. The phones were made from heavy plastic. Their mouthpieces were connected to the machinery of the telephone with tightly corkscrewed rubber cables. The phones had rotary dials on them and illuminated square buttons along their bottoms that were labeled with the names of other extensions within the silo called Eden. Not one of us had ever used a phone like the ones we found in the silo. I could hear a dial tone in them, and I'm certain I could have figured out how to place a call, but we decided there was no one any of us wanted to talk to anyway. We found out that Shan's and Robbie's cell phones did not work inside the silo. We discovered Eden's cafeteria, a museum piece in stainless steel and formica. There were soda taps behind the buffet lines, with machines that must have been producing ice cubes for several days. The only soda brand I recognized was Coca-Cola. There was also something called Nesbitt's, which was orange, and another piss-colored beverage named Werner's. The taps worked. The sodas came out cold and carbonated. It was another miracle. Free sodas. And there was a warehouse filled with food. The food was all boxed in cardboard and contained green cans of just about every imaginable concoction you could eat. There were green foil pouches of peanut butter, and every one of the boxes contained small packs of cigarettes. This was the same kind of stuff the United States of America sent to its troops fighting in Vietnam, cigarettes and all. "Thank you, St. Casimir's," I said. "Thank you, St. Casimir's," Robbie repeated. Shan would not compromise her unsteady Lutheranism, most likely because she did not smoke. "Robbie and I both went to church on Sunday," I pointed out.
"I was moving in," Shan explained. "No one expects you to go to church when you're unpacking boxes."
There were enough boxes in Eden for us to unpack that we'd never have to go to church again. Gideon's breeding rights. Shan's bedroom had a door that led into a brick wall and another that dead-ended at the foot of a stairwell. It was what I called a dungeon for horny Polish boys. In truth, the silo called Eden went all the way into the foundation of the McKeon house, and the doorways in Shan's room had been bricked off when the Eden Project work crews finished construction on Dr. Grady McKeon's subterranean shelter. Just as those McKeon industry scientists back in the 1960s had been playing with self-sustaining universes they trapped inside globes of glass, the bigger enclosed bubble project they'd been working on lay beneath the ground under Shan's bedroom and stretched beyond the derelict cornfields on Dr. Grady McKeon's own property. Here is what we found. Eden had a gymnasium, a fitness center with polished wood floors and weightlifting equipment, a sauna, and another shower room. There was a small facility for laundry that put the Ealing coin wash laundrette to shame in terms of its cleanliness and lack of discarded condoms and cigarette butts on the floor. There was even a salon with those old-fashioned hair dryers that looked like brainwashing torture machines from science fiction movies, barber chairs, and haircutting tools. Shan looked at her hair in the mirror. As always, it was beautiful, the color of mature wheat in late August. Her skin was perfect and unblemished. I said, "Would you like us to do something with your hair?" Shan said, "Do either of you guys know anything about hairstyles?" And Robbie continued our string of unanswered questions with, "Why are you both looking at me? Do you think it's just natural that I'd be, like, into doing hair and shit?" Later, we found Eden's dormitories. Naturally, I was incapable of wandering through the bedrooms with Shan and Robbie without feeling horny and guilty. I wondered if there had ever been threesomes inside Shan's silo. Each room had two double beds. They looked, in style, like hotel rooms, except they lacked bathrooms and toilets. which were all located at the center of a hub of hallways that connected the fitness center and the lecture hall, an entry room where we had changed out of our Iowa surface dweller clothing. There wasn't much room for argument in the discussion we had as we explored the bedrooms. Eden was built to house survivors for the end of the world. We could say the idea was to protect a few human specimens in the event of a nuclear war, but Robbie and I knew Eden was probably built for something else entirely. The idea that Robbie and Shan and I were inside some kind of breeding compound for the genesis of an entire new species of humans was particularly thrilling and attractive. If we never came out of Eden, the three of us would be able to start an entire new race of underground Iowans, I said. Robbie was unenthusiastic. Well, if we had to, I offered. Between you, me, and Shan, we would have enough genetic diversity to not breed two-headed boys and shit like that. I was somehow working into a long-range threesome strategy. Robbie repeated. Shan said,
I bet that's what Grady McKeon had in mind with the whole idea of Eden, starting everything over.
Everyone who eventually came out would just end up doing the same stupid shit that always happened up there, I said, and pointed my thumb at the world above us.
We should leave a copy of Porcupine's History of the World down here, just to save mankind the trouble, Robbie said.
That would be a good strategy, I said. When do you two suppose we might start working on the new species? Shan rolled her eyes and pushed my chest. I liked that. She also changed the subject.
There must be books or stuff like that down here, Shan said.
Robbie jumped on one of the beds like it was a trampoline. He said we should all do that, so Shan and I joined him. It was fun. We made a mess of that room. It was ours anyway. Nobody could stop us. I pulled out my little medal of St. Casimir's and looked at him, and thought about how difficult the boy saint's life must have been. I hopped down onto the floor. I pulled open the drawers on the nightstands at the head of the double bed Shan and Robbie were jumping on. There was a Gideon's Bible inside, but, naturally, there would be no condoms in Eden. Every room had a Gideon's Bible in it. Grady McKeon must have worked some kind of deal with those Gideon people. Maybe he promised to let them leave some sperm down here, besides just a bunch of Bibles, I thought. We had no idea of the time when we were down in Eden. We also had no idea what was beginning to happen up above us in Ealing. Nobody did. The Queen of the Universe. We found Eden's library at exactly the same time the Hoover Boys and Grant Wallace found Eileen Pope and Hungry Jack in the alley at Grasshopper Jungle. Now Eileen was very busy. She was getting filled up with the seeds of a new apex species for planet Earth. She was happy. Eileen was the queen of the new universe. But she was hungry, too. While Devin Stoddard, the same Hoover boy who had kneed me in the balls the Friday before and was now a lumbering 6-foot-tall mantis beast, pumped future generations of little Devin bugs into Eileen Pope's swelling abdomen, she pivoted her thoracic midsection around clockwise and clamped Devin's head in the toothy mace of her grasping arms. Devin Stoddard did not resist. He pumped and pumped and pumped. Devin Stoddard continued pumping semen into Eileen Pope even after she had eaten his entire head. Eileen Pope was doing the two things bugs like to do. The other bugs watched and waited. They wanted more turns on Eileen Pope, even if she was still hungry after eating Devin Stoddard. When Eileen Pope finished eating, the only thing left of Devin Stoddard was a gooey smear across the floral sofa in Grasshopper Jungle. And, at the exact moment we found Eden's library, and Eileen Pope was crunching her way through Devin Stoddard's exoskeleton to get to the slick and nourishing goodness inside her mate, Johnny McKeon was locking up from attic to cellar consignment store for the night. Johnny decided to take a box of garbage out to the dumpster in the alley of Grasshopper Jungle. It was not a good idea. The library and the new tally-ho. History shows that an examination of the personal collection of titles in any men's library will provide something of a glimpse into his soul. Such was the case with Dr. Grady McKeon's library beneath the ground. Here was Dr. Grady McKeon's collection of books. There was a wall of novels, and every one of the novels in Dr. Grady McKeon's library was an American work. Also, every novel had been written by a man. Before going down into Eden, I never knew that American men had written so many books and shit. The men who wrote the books in Dr. Grady McKeon's library weren't just guys. They were monuments and had names like Melville, Hawthorne, Twain, Fitzgerald, Faulkner, Dreiser, and on and on. The most recent novel, if you could call it that, was The Old Man and the Sea by Ernest Hemingway. There was not a copy of The Chocolate War, however, but that stood to reason. Another wall in Dr. Grady McKean's library was filled with books on all kinds of scientific subjects. Botany, evolution, taxonomy, genetics, and reproduction. The books on reproduction caught my eye. They were very old and conservatively worded, however. But the most wonderful feature of Dr. Grady McKean's library were the rows of desks, each of which had been furnished with supplies for writing and drawing. It was meant to be that Eden would have its historian. "This is meant to be," I said. I sat down at one of the desks and looked through the assortment of pens and empty leather-bound logbooks. I felt around with my feet in the carpeting beneath where I sat. It was difficult for me to adequately concentrate on writing without Ingrid sighing under my toes. So I said, "What am I going to do, Shan?" Shan said,
"I don't know, Austin."
Shan was smart. She knew I was troubled about things. She always let me have room. In some ways, Shan was like Ingrid. "This is where I will write the history of the end of the world," I said. Shan said,
"Huh."
Then I picked up some thick permanent markers and opened their caps. Naturally, I smelled them. I do not know why, because that is not my job. But history shows that every time a teenage boy opens a permanent marker, he will first sniff it before deciding how to go about defacing the planet. That is what I did. On the empty wall above the desk where I sat, I drew a big hairy thing, a bison, in as close a likeness as I could manage to the figure that had been drawn so many centuries before on the wall of a cave at a place called Altamira. Maybe it was my great times 1000 grandfather who'd drawn the Altamira bison. It would have been back when the world was like this, messed up and poisonous, and a few scared and confused specimens found their way inside a cave called Altamira that may just as well have been a silo called Eden. They would have gone down in that cave to start things over again. Perhaps my great times 1000 grandfather also smoked cigarettes and wore a medallion of a virgin Polish saint around his neck. He would have experimented too. Maybe he was also confused about the people he was in love with, and whether or not there was something wrong with him for frequently finding himself sexually attracted to the guy he grew up with. You know what I mean. Thinking about being inside a cave with Robbie and Shan made me feel very horny. Robbie said,
"Nice cow, Austin."
"It is a bison," I pointed out.
"Oh,"
Robbie said, and he added,
"Nice buff, porcupine."
Robbie and Shan were great friends, true friends. They both allowed me the space that I needed. While I wrote the history of our day inside Eden, Shan and Robbie sat and waited quietly. But there was still so much of the silo we had to explore, so I rushed and abbreviated, and when I was satisfied that I had gotten down the important details of our discovery, I tucked the logbook under my arm and led the way out of the library and deeper into the mysteries of Dr. Grady McKeon's sealed-in universe. Just across the hallway from Eden's library was a bar. An actual bar, inside a compound designed to resurrect mankind. Robbie said,
"I christen this bar New Tally-Ho." "Eden 5 needs a gay bar," Shan said.
"Everywhere needs gay bars, Shan," I pointed out. This was true. We went inside the New Tally-Ho. In the same way the Eden No Coins Required launderette put to shame the dirty laundry joint at Grasshopper Jungle, the New Tally-Ho was immeasurably more luxurious than Waterloo, Iowa's one and only gay bar. There were built-in wine coolers and every kind of liquor I had ever heard of in my life, and some others I had not. There was a bottle of something called Krupnik, which came from Poland. Once again, all roads crossed where I stood. The New Tally-Ho was impressively furnished, with a wide mahogany serving bar and a floor-to-ceiling mirror behind racks of immaculately arranged bottles and crystalware. There was a pool table with a perfect felt surface. It sat in the middle of the floor with plenty of space around for proper play. A dartboard hung on one wall. The chalkboard beside it still recorded a match from 4 decades back between someone named Doc and another player named Virgil. Doc, apparently, was not such a good dart player. We killed this big hairy thing. We played darts. And that was our day. None of us was in the mood to try drinking alcohol. Drinking was reckless and made us unconcerned about doing stupid shit. I said, "Let's not get drunk, Robbie." We agreed to save that experiment for some other time. Robbie knew what I meant. After our trip through the bar, we found a medical clinic that looked like it was equipped to do surgery.
"Lots of drugs in here," Shan said.
"An entire navy of kayaks," I added. Eden was built like a starfish. Its arms radiated outward from the room we called the lecture hall, which was just beyond the mudroom and lockers and showers, where Dr. Grady McKeon had somehow managed to install a salvaged antique Nightingale urinal. At the end of the arm that housed the medical clinic, there was a full-sized bowling alley with two complete lanes and a rack of balls and shoes, all of which had been personalized with the names of their owners. Seeing those relics, as well as the scoreboard that had been kept for darts in the bar, made me suddenly aware that all the first people who had ever been down inside Eden were most likely dead.
This is kind of creepy, Shan said.
She stared at a swirling pink bowling ball with dainty finger holes and a gold-etched name on it that said Wanda May. Wanda May was the first queen of Eden. She was fertile, left-handed, and enjoyed having sex with multiple partners in Eden. Wanda May also liked to bowl. People in Iowa liked to bowl. Robbie said,
Bowling creeps me out too, Shan, except for the fact that it is the only sport that encourages its participants to smoke cigarettes.
I wanted a cigarette. I tapped Robbie's shoulder. I did not have to say anything to him. Robbie Breeze always knew what I was thinking, even when I was thinking about something other than smoking. We lit cigarettes and backtracked to the final unexplored arm of the place called Eden. And there we found the most important treasure the silo had yet to offer up, Eden's movie theater. I will tell you. Ventilator Blues. Back in the lounge, Robbie uncovered a cache of reel-to-reel tapes in the cupboard below the tape machine.
I would be happy to stay down here forever, Robbie said.
The future of mankind is, inside our jumpsuits, I said.
I wonder what time it is, Shan said.
It is time to begin the rebuilding of the universe with hybrid Austin Shan Robbie offspring, I answered. I did not want Shan to think about leaving the silo. Robbie held up a box with a glossy black and white photo printed on its cover. It held a real copy of Exile on Main Street.
It's a miracle. This is like heaven, Robbie said.
Eden, I corrected. Exile on Main Street, according to Robert Breeze Jr., was the most brilliant rock album ever created.
In Eden, it is permanently the 1970s, Robbie affirmed.
I never want to go home again, I said. Robbie wanted us to spend the night in Shan's silo. He said,
Let's sleep here tonight.
I'll cook dinner, I offered. The opportunity was daring and thrilling to me. My heart raced with the thought of an Eden slumber party. Shan said,
I can't spend the night with two boys. What would my mom say?
I said, She will probably say for you to use condoms.
Shut up,
Shan answered. You are right, Shan. Eden needs us to not use condoms. It is our duty to repopulate planet Earth with our handsome Iowan children, I said. Robbie threaded the new tape onto the machine. Robbie and I smoked. The three of us were having a beautiful time in Eden. We laughed, and I drew pictures of Shan and Robbie in their jumpsuits, dancing together. I asked Robbie to recite Dulce et Decorum Est, and he did. It was beautiful. I wanted to watch Robbie kiss Shan. I wanted Robbie to kiss her the real way, like I would, but there was no way Robbie would just do something like that. The song that played was called Ventilator Blues. Everybody walking round, everybody trying to step on their creator. Something always happens while someone else dances. Here is what happened while Shan and Robbie danced together, and I fantasized about watching Robbie put his tongue in Shan's mouth. Johnny McKeon stepped out into the alley at Grasshopper Jungle. Johnny carried a cardboard banana box someone had left behind in the garage of a foreclosed home in Ealing. Johnny McKeon intended to toss the garbage into the same dumpster that Hungry Jack ate from at least once per week. Hungry Jack's real name was Charles R. Hooford. Charles R. Hooford was born in Indiana and had served in the United States Army in Vietnam, where he participated in the extermination of an entire village of women, children, and elderly people. Hungry Jack was now a claw-armed, 6-foot-tall praying mantis thing, and he was waiting in line to fuck Eileen Pope. Eileen Pope had been breeding all day, and she was nearing exhaustion. Eileen Pope was also a claw-armed, 6-foot-tall praying mantis that had just eaten her most recent sexual partner, the Hoover boy named Devin Stoddard. Devin Stoddard kneed me in the balls on the previous Friday when he and his friends beat me and Robbie Breeze up for being queers. I was pretty sure I was not exactly queer, but I was not certain. Devin Stoddard was born in Crete, Nebraska. He once got fired from a part-time job bagging groceries at the Hy-Vee for smoking marijuana in a parked car when he was supposed to be gathering shopping carts. At that moment, Eileen Pope's husband, Travis Pope, was inside the pancake house, which looked as though it had been fire-hosed with blood and ground meat. Travis Pope ate 9 people inside the pancake house. It was a terrible mess. Travis Pope had been very hungry after fucking Eileen all day long, ever since they had hatched out in the wreckage of Travis's Nissan truck. Travis Pope also enjoyed the sugary taste of spilled imitation maple-flavored syrup on raw human beings. Travis Pope had never been a blueberry syrup man. The imitation maple-flavored syrup served by the pancake house was made in New Jersey. At the same time Johnny McKeon opened the back door to From Attic to Cellar consignment store, Eileen Pope clamped her 4 bristly upper arms into the woven fabric on the sofa in Grasshopper Jungle, while Grant Wallace impregnated her over and over and over. Hungry Jack and the 2 remaining Hoover boys, who were also now claw-armed 6-foot-tall praying mantises, postured and hissed with their toothy arms erect, sparring over who would get to deposit his semen inside Eileen Pope next. Eileen Pope was nearly finished getting pregnant. She was as fertilized as a genetically modified cornfield in Kansas, and was getting ready to lay millions of squirming eggs. Eileen Pope was still hungry, too. Eileen Pope decided she would eat Grant Wallace soon, and then she could go find a dark, protected place to build her foaming mass of eggs. Johnny McKeon did not notice the breeding swarm of bugs as he walked out into Grasshopper Jungle carrying his box of refuse. The box Johnny carried was full of VHS porno movies. The movies were made in a place called the San Fernando Valley, which is near Los Angeles, California. Johnny McKeon did not enjoy watching pornography anymore. He had grown out of that preoccupation. Johnny would have given the tapes to Ollie Jungfrau, but Ollie stayed home from work at Tipsy Cricket Liquors that day. Ollie was lucky. Ollie Jungfrau would have wanted those movies. Ollie was a connoisseur of porn, and he especially enjoyed sex films from the 1980s, which was when these particular ones had been made. It was just past 8 on Thursday evening. Ingrid was still sleeping beneath the desk in my bedroom. Will Wallace was driving home from the tally-ho in Waterloo. Will Wallace was drunk. He glanced at himself repeatedly in his rearview mirror, and he thought about the young man from Vinton, Iowa, who had been hitting on him during happy hour at the tally-ho. The man who'd been hitting on Will Wallace was a paramedic. He was handsome and lonely. Will Wallace wondered what it would be like if he tried being queer. He had never experimented when he was a teenager, but he tried to imagine himself doing something sexual with the handsome young paramedic from Vinton. Will Wallace was drunk and excited by the thought. He was very horny by the time he got to Ealing. Will knew what he would do to his wife as soon as he got the chance. Will Wallace had a vasectomy. He thought about buying some condoms at Tipsy Cricket Liquors, just in case he ever got especially drunk and daring with anyone in Waterloo. Will Wallace tried calling home on his cell phone, but there was no answer. Sometimes his wife got angry at him for coming home drunk after hanging out at Waterloo, Iowa's one and only gay bar. Will assumed his wife was not answering her phone because she was mad at him. The actual reason she was not picking up her phone was that she had been eaten by Grant Wallace, who was at one time Will's son. Will Wallace decided to make amends for flirting with a gay man. He stopped off at Satan's Pizza and ordered a surprise Stan Prime for his wife and children. For dessert, he thought his wife, whose name was Dorothy, would like something sweet and alcoholic. So Will drove across the street to Tipsy Cricket Liquors, where he planned to buy some condoms for himself and coffee liqueur and vanilla ice cream for Dorothy Wallace. It was not such a good idea. Here is what happened at Grasshopper Jungle while I watched and dreamed about Shan and Robbie dancing together. Johnny McKeon dropped his box of VHS pornos at his feet. He said something like, "What the hey," or "Ain't that strange," when he saw the 6-foot-tall bugs that buzzed and vibrated around the abandoned sofa in the alley. Johnny McKeon never cussed. Eileen Pope was crunching her way down through Grant Wallace's triangular head. Grant was still pumping his semen into her oviduct, and his pincers clamped rigidly into Eileen's thorax. One of Grant Wallace's arms broke off and it flexed, opened and closed, wriggling in the stew of piss and insect semen on the asphalt of Grasshopper Jungle. Tyler Jacobson, one of the other Hoover boys, who was now a 6-foot-tall, tooth-armed monster, picked up Grant Wallace's twitching arm and began eating it like a massive stalk of celery. Roger Baird, the remaining Hoover boy bug, attempted to mount Eileen Pope and impregnate her as she ate Grant Wallace, who was also still joined with Eileen in the final act of making future clusters of little Grant Wallace larvae inside her. Hungry Jack rotated his head toward the sound of the crashing box of porno tapes. His arms spiked high, and his useless wings flared out from the carapace coverings along his backside. It was an impressive and threatening pose for a large male mantis. Then Hungry Jack came scuttling straight across the alley at Johnny McKeon. Johnny probably said, "What the hey," again, and fell back through the open door to From Attic to Cellar Consignment Store. Will Wallace was just pulling up to the front of Tipsy Cricket Liquors. He was horny and drunk, and the inside of his Volvo smelled like a Stan Preem. He did not even notice Travis Pope standing in front of the Pancake House. Will Wallace just took Travis Pope for someone having a cigarette break, as opposed to someone who had been transformed by contained MI Plague Strain 412E into a gigantic carnivorous bug that was more powerful than a wild tiger. By the time Will Wallace's eye caught hold of the unnatural form of Travis Pope, he was already within striking range of Travis's lightning-fast barbed arms. Travis Pope wasn't exactly hungry, but prey excited him as much as Eileen Pope's oviduct did. Travis fired his clawed arms at Will Wallace and crushed Will's ribcage between them. Will Wallace did not even have time to gasp. Travis carried Will Wallace, who thrashed and kicked uselessly, into the Pancake House. Travis Pope smeared Will Wallace's hair through a puddle of imitation maple-flavored syrup. Then Travis ate him like a piece of French toast. Johnny McKeon managed to slam shut the thick, solid-core door that opened from his secondhand store onto the back alley at Grasshopper Jungle. Johnny had stumbled upon the scene of cannibalistic bugs as big as grizzly bears that fucked and ate at the same time, which were the two things that bugs like to do. Hungry Jack was a mere half-second too slow to catch Johnny McKeon. As Johnny bolted shut the door, Hungry Jack punched his spiked arms into the wood. The barbs on Hungry Jack's arms bored two-thirds of the way through the door. Bugs are not smart. Hungry Jack could have easily hammered the door into toothpicks. As soon as the door was shut, Hungry Jack forgot all about Johnny McKeon. Although he knew he was still hungry, Hungry Jack went back to wait on another turn with Eileen Pope. Eileen Pope and the two surviving Hoover boys were gone. Hungry Jack sniffed and sniffed at the air, trying to smell her. But Eileen Pope was no longer emitting the powerful hormones that had attracted him and the other males in the first place. Johnny McKeon was smart. Since the break-in at Tipsy Cricket Liquors the previous Friday, Johnny had installed an alarm system that connected his businesses to the Iowa State Patrol. Johnny McKeon activated his alarm. The Iowa State Patrol, which operated from a substation in Waterloo, was alerted to an emergency at the Ealing Mall. A patrol car with a state trooper from Waterloo was on its way. It was not a good idea. At that moment, it was early morning in Germany. My brother, Eric Zerba, was lying on his back in a hospital bed. An intravenous needle pumped drugs and fluids into his arm, and other things had been taped to his body to tell whether or not Eric Zerba was still alive. A thin plastic tube had been inserted into the opening of Eric Zerba's penis so he could urinate. The tube was manufactured in Ohio. It was called a catheter, as opposed to a nightingale. Eric pushed numbers on the display of a cell phone. Eric Zerba was calling me, but I left my phone inside my house. Eric Zerba would not have known that cell phones do not work in Eden. Eric Zerba was also crying. Ingrid rolled herself out from her place at my desk. She went across the room and pulled a pair of my discarded blue Iowa plaid boxers out from under the bed. She sniffed the boxers and rested her damp nose in them. This is what Ingrid did sometimes when she was lonely, or when she needed to take her mind off shitting. It was Ingrid's silent way of kissing me. Ah Hwang Sing, who most people called Lewis, kissed Connie Breeze one last time before leaving the Del Vista Arms. Connie was in the shower. She was standing naked in the same grimy tub where I took a shower Tuesday before school. I had also vomited in that same bathroom. Lewis pulled the yellowed curtain back and looked at Connie Breeze. He wanted to have sex again, but Connie told him no because her son would probably be home any minute now. Connie Breeze had to get ready for work. She took two Xanax as soon as Ah Hwang Sing left the apartment. When the song finished playing, Shan kissed Robbie and told him thank you for dancing. It was not the kind of kiss I hoped to see. Shan kissed the side of Robbie's cheek. I stared at Robbie's perfect neck and jaw. Shan's breasts looked especially full and heavy beneath the shimmer of her jumpsuit. Robbie was a little embarrassed. He knew what I was thinking. Robbie always knew what I was thinking. Robbie Breeze turned red when Shan kissed him. I lit a cigarette. Lucky, in Polish boy names. Good books are about everything. This is my history. Unze Sturba and Hermann Weinbach became great friends. Unze Sturba was also my great-grandfather. After they left the soup kitchen in Ames, Unze Sturba and Hermann Weinbach walked through the night. They tried to find a place where they could sleep and stay warm. They fed breadcrumbs to Baby, who almost immediately began to impersonate Hermann Weinbach. Hermann habitually used expressions like ach and nu. Baby began saying ach and nu, too. Unze thought it was funny. The boys believed they were headed toward California. But the following day, they took a ride from a family whose pickup truck had been loaded with all their household belongings. And Hermann Weinbach and Unze Sturba ended up at an abandoned farm outside of a place called Midvale, which was also in Iowa. Nobody even knew the boys had moved themselves into the place. They lived there together, with Baby, a talking European starling, for nearly a year. On their third night in the abandoned farmhouse, Unze Sturba and Hermann Weinbach slept together. Hermann Weinbach was homosexual. At first, Unze found the situation to be awkward and frustrating. What Hermann Weinbach and Unze Sturba did together evolved into something substantially more than an experiment. So Unze was confused, very much like his great-grandson, who would also be named Unze. But Unze Sturba also enjoyed the closeness of sleeping with Hermann Weinbach. Unze had never kissed any person other than his mother, Eva Nightingale, and his father, Chris Sturba, in his entire life. Young Unze enjoyed kissing Hermann Weinbach very much. Hermann Weinbach was experienced, and Unze felt tremendous pleasure and satisfaction in sharing the sex the two of them enjoyed together. Nobody knew anything about Unze and Hermann. They fell as deeply in love with each other as anyone in the entire history of mankind. That is the truth. Unze loved Hermann, but he told him he would never become a communist. Hermann Weinbach laughed about that. Baby imitated everything the boys said to each other. Baby said, "Ach, being a communist homosexual Jew in Iowa is like being a bird that speaks Polish." And Baby also said, "I believe I'm in love with you, Hermann Weinbach. And I love you with all my heart, Unze Sturba." The boys hunted and scrounged, sometimes begging for food to stay alive. They were very happy together in Midvale. Nobody bothered them at all. Baby flew around the house with them, and every night Unze and Hermann slept together in their lover's bed. They had found the bed in the home's attic on the morning after their initial experiment. They had pulled the bed down to the home's living room, so they could sleep beside the fireplace, where they burned furniture and sometimes even the doors from kitchen cupboards to stay warm. They loved each other. In January of 1934, Hermann Weinbach became ill with pneumonia. He died while Unze held him in bed. Unze Sturba was completely lost without Hermann. Unze asked the bird, "What am I going to do, baby?" Unze cried for days and days without leaving